Sports. Weekday afternoons from
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday, so that means my co-host Sandy Williams is on board. Sandy, Governor says Texas isn't shooting migrants because Biden would charge us with murder. Let me ask you. This is Governor Abbott. This is a United States governor, Sandy, who makes a statement like that boldly and for the world to hear it. And somehow he'll get upset if somebody, you know, calls him a racist. But he makes a statement like that as if you were with a governor. Where are the people who are supposed to tell him, hey, Governor Abbott, that was probably a stupid thing to say. Don't say it.
Well, is he suggesting that if someone else was president, they would go ahead and shoot them because they wouldn't get charged
with
murder?
Governor Greg Abbott said his state continued to use every tool in its arsenal to stop migrants along the border with Mexico, but added that the only thing his officials weren't doing was shooting people who come across the border. And he then made the statement, Texas isn't shooting migrants because Biden would charge us with murder. I mean, that part of it is just asinine. Is it safe to say that?
Well, yeah, I guess. I mean, the suggestion is that if someone else was president, then maybe they would do the shooting because they wouldn't get charged with murder. That's interesting. I can't believe the American public thinks that's the right kind of border policy to use.
Well, Sandy, my point is that kind of verbiage, you know, I don't know. You were around a governor. It certainly governors are different depending on where they're from. People are different. But you couldn't have imagined Governor Knowles. What was the governor's?
Governor Lucey was the fellow I worked with.
You couldn't imagine him.
It's all politics. I mean, obviously, he's saying this for a base, for an audience that savors the notion that, Texas is a state filled right. with people who carry guns. And I don't know. It's an outlook. It's expressing a whole set of sort of values that I find totally foreign.
Sandy, today, with people being what they are, I mean, for heaven's sake, Sandy, let's look at where we are today in our nation. People threatening to shoot judges. People threatening to shoot lawyers, people threatening to kill congresspeople. Sandy, when you really should be careful when you're in those types of positions, shouldn't you? People take those things literally.
Yeah, you would think so. I mean, ex-president Trump in the court proceeding talked about how this country would be bedlam. That was a bit of a dog whistle to his followers. Like, you know, if this happens, the country will be bedlam. It's like, it's more than just predicting. It's essentially threatening. And that's, you know, the problem is that this has become all too regular, the speech like this. And it's really political speech. It's aimed at stirring people up hitting some chord that they share. It's just a sorry thing that you could predict that there's a political cord that people would share that involves shooting people who are trying to come across the border.
Well, you know, Sandy, and again, you were in government. It is, and I know this wasn't the kind of language that, and maybe I don't know it, to be quite frank with you, I wasn't there, but I don't recall this kind of hyperbole, out in the public. Maybe they said things behind closed doors, but for heaven's sakes, to be so bold as to make those kind of statements, Sandy, in light of day.
Well, particularly when there are vigilante groups, armed vigilante groups, defending the border. You know, right. they're, that's actually a phenomenon ongoing in Texas. So it's sort of like giving them the whole problem with this kind of speech is that it's created sort of a legitimacy to it. It's to onto itself, and violent talk has become something closer to a norm, whereas it used to be way outside the norm.
Yeah, you know, Sandy, I just wish we could be honest and upfront about, you know, what is really going on in the minds of, unfortunately, far too many people in this country now. Let me go to this story, Sandy. $1 billion that they can find right now of that has been of weaponry that has been given to Ukraine, they can't account for. You talked long ago about the fact, and it's probably more than a billion, but you talked long ago about whether or not they could be trusted
Ukraine. Yeah, I mean, Ukraine is a country that's at least as corrupt as Russia. The two of them are sister countries, really, in every respect, including culturally and including having a corruption as sort of a norm. OK, and there's been an effort of apparently under Zelensky to try and clean it up in Ukraine. But there was no question that when you're sending tens of billions of dollars into a country, and a bunch of that money is being sent in the form of dollars and not munitions, a bunch of it is going to get routed into people's pockets illegally. And in fact, you know, Zelensky has had to clean house several times with respect to generals for corruption, with respect to people who are responsible for the draft for corruption, and people who are responsible for the acquisition by the government of armaments for corruption. So it's not a surprise.
The Defense Department has not properly kept tabs on more than $1 billion worth of shoulder-fired missiles, night vision goggles, one-way attack drones, and other sensitive equipment that the United States has provided to Ukraine. The Pentagon's Inspector General said in a report, and probably much more. So we know if they're saying a billion, Sandy, that's, you know, that's the bottom number. It's probably a lot more than that.
My guess is it is. And, you know, that's, you know, when we were got so enthusiastically in support of Ukraine, starting in about 2010, when we became quite involved on both sides of the issues. There were the Russian nationalists in Ukraine, and there were the Ukrainian nationalists. And both of them had lobbies going in Washington. Both of them had people like Paul Manafort, who was apparently working with the Russian nationalist version of the Ukrainians. We had others working with the Ukrainian nationalists in Washington. And we become quite fascinated with this country, apparently because it was important to Russia, and also because it was a place where lots of people could make lots of money. I'm just surprised that we are now surprised that when we ended up sending tens of billions of dollars there, that a bunch of it might have been misdirected.
You know, the watchdog's findings, which raise questions about the United States' ability to ensure that its weapons are not stolen, were disclosed at perhaps the inopportune time for the Biden administration, as its existing funding to help Ukraine runs out. So this information is coming out now, Sandy, as President Biden is asking for an additional $60 billion to give to Ukraine. And Republicans are clearly using this as a prerequisite for why we shouldn't be sending those weapons. And, you know, your thoughts.
Well, my thoughts are that now equivocating about aiding Ukraine would be the surest indication of an inherent weakness of America, okay? Not the weakness of Donald Trump or the weakness of the president, but a weakness of the system we have, where partisan politics can cause a promise made to be broken down the road, okay? Or a seeming commitment that was made to be broken. And so CJ wants to talk about weak presidents, but actually a system that would cause Ukraine to lose its aid from the United States and to be put into a far weaker posture vis-a-vis its capacity to stand up to Russia would be a sure indication of a weakness in terms of relying on America or worrying about America. And so I guess I'm surprised that it would be the Republicans who would be taking this position, in spite of the fact that I am a skeptic and have been a skeptic about the way we have approached formulating our policy in Eastern Europe. And I also believe that we should have a far better grip on the auditing of money we send to people. But when you're sending money in an emergency basis in which the money has to flow quickly, we know that results in corruption. Look at the corruption during the Trump administration under the PPP program that was there for COVID, right? We had billions of dollars misdirected under the various programs that were there to sort of rescue the economy during COVID, because the money had to get out very quickly and it wasn't monitored very well.
You know, after this is all said and done, Sandy, Republicans clearly, it looks as though these billions of dollars aren't going to be going to Ukraine. And I don't know, Sandy, do we bear some burden as a nation if these dollars don't wind up in Ukraine at a time when Russia is getting ready to basically escalate things, knowing that these weapons aren't coming? Do we bear some burden as a nation?
Well, you know,
Hold the thought, Sandy. 844-967-2789 is the number. You can join us. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. Sandy Williams is my co-host. At 844-967-2789. It's a winter wonderland. Sandy Williams, my co-host, is on board. Sandy, for those who, you know, may not know, you are an attorney by trade. And if you had a client who hired you to represent him or her, and you're sitting in court and, you know, I'm the guy who hired you to speak on my behalf because you're the guy who understands law and how those things work. That's what an attorney is. And myself as a layperson does not understand law. So that's why we have to hire an attorney to represent us in legal cases. And yet I dismiss all the things that I've hired you to do and say because I want to speak my mind, as Donald Trump did after all of the time that they've been in court and the lawyers have been fighting for him to protect his backside, he refused to get on the stand, Sandy, and any testimony. But at the end, he had something to say. And he got diarrhea of the mouth. And the people who've been defending him couldn't get him to shut up. What happens in that case?
Donald Trump understands that this is a trial that's a publicity trial. It's a PR trial. It's a political trial. If it sticks to the facts, he's pretty much screwed. You know, they've got him, particularly in the fraud trial, they've got him sort of dead to rights. So what he's got to do is put a lot of pressure on the system, political pressure on the system. And so he's the pressure guy, right? I mean, his lawyers are in court arguing things that relate to the court proceeding, but he's a goner on that in all likelihood. And the only thing he can hope for is that he puts so much pressure on the court that they ignore the law and they ignore the evidence and they do something else. And so, you know, he's a wily guy, wily coyote. Yeah, he's you know, I would say he's shrewd. You know, I don't think when he opens his mouth and talks, it's foolishness. But it's the kind of foolishness that seems to appeal to a base. He gets publicity every day. He's got people defending him. He's got people believing that he's a martyr, that the system is out to get him, that the deep state is filled with a bunch of sort of evil liberals who will play whack-a-mole with any kind of a conservative who sticks his head up. He claims to be a conservative. People even give him credit for that when there's almost nothing that's ideologically conservative about his approach. So he's a one-off, and he's successful in his capacity as a one-off.
So he's a little more shrewd than any of us give him credit for.
Yeah, I think he's too smart by one half, but yeah, I think he's quite shrewd. in the areas that he's shrewd about, I think he's very shrewd about how to manipulate and handle public opinion.
You know, is public opinion enough to force judges and juries to be manipulated based on public opinion? If that's the case, Sandy, then what kind of system do we have?
That's the point. That's why people correctly say that our democracy is under the test right now, because our democracy is premised on the rule of law. It's premised on courts acting as courts should behave, looking at evidence, understanding the law, making decisions. That's the primary premise of a democracy. That's what defends each person and the rights of each person. And if that can get overridden by broad public opinion, if that gets overridden by political might, we've lost it. We've lost the game. And so that's really I think you put your finger on it. That is the problem for democracy right now.
You know, and so the average Joe, then, when they have their day in court, they're not getting, they think, a fair, assessment. And they're thinking that, hey, man, this is all, as Donald Trump says, rigged against the average little guy, because he doesn't have the resources. And so he sits in court and he's going to abide by the law of the land and the rules. And that's probably when the little guy looks and sees this, he really gets frustrated, man. You know,
well, that's like
that's the fear, huh?
Yeah, I mean, the confidence in the courts, the confidence in the impartiality of how laws are levied on us is fundamental. Okay, and Donald Trump is trying to test that right now. He's basically saying that that an important political figure, an ex-president, is immune, and he's trying to use public opinion to make himself, to inoculate himself against, for instance, this court proceeding, this civil fraud court proceeding.
You know, Sandy, you know, let's do this. Let's go to the phone lines. Let's go to Tom from LA. Go ahead, Tom.
Hey, Sandy, I have a question for you. I really respect you a lot. Can you tell us, Matt Flynn talks about how fascism creeps in a little cat's feet. Can you tell us, because whoever the Republican candidate that wins, I personally believe will be fascistic, and we are moving towards fascism and away from democracy. We're probably already an oligarchy where the corporations own our politicians through legal bribery. Can you tell me what fascism looks like?
Well, it's interesting, the word fascism tends to give rise to the notion of sort of a government that's, for instance, going to conduct a Holocaust, or it's a government that is as evil as the Nazi. Nazis gave fascism a terrible name, and the fact is that fascism has the capacity to create the horror that was Nazi Germany. Fascism is basically putting the government, making the government God. The government becomes the end justifies the means with respect to the government being in control, and fascism tends to lead to autocracy, because it's the person who's in charge of the government becomes that person who is imbued with all the power and authority of the government, and becomes the autocratic leader. And so the government is the be all and end all for society. And, fascism has become difficult to describe. It does have a philosophical definition that is more benign than the outcome that usually occurs.
All right. 844-967-2789 is the number. It's Friday. It means Fridays with my co-host, Sandy Williams. You can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. It's Friday. It means Friday's with my co-host, Sandy Williams. Sandy, help me understand, if you would please, sir. As House GOP launches effort to impeach Mayorkas, the Republican senators want to strike a border deal with him. So... is that what they call an oxymoron?
That's called a hardball for sure. we're gonna fire you. We're gonna have a public proceeding, but incidentally, we want to negotiate with you over what. The whole process of the way the Congress has been dealing with the border and immigration has been a political theater, and it has been for a long time, ever since I think George Bush II put together his commission. They came up with a bunch of recommendations, none of which were followed, because it turns out that the people who want to wave their arms and argue about the huge problems at the border don't really want to take the steps necessary to resolve the immigration system and solve it. They want to talk about a Band-Aid. A wall, okay. The wall doesn't solve how many immigrants we're going to allow in, how we're going to test and decide which immigrants come in, how we're going to fund our immigration services so we have enough manpower to deal with the numbers that we're asked to deal with. None of that gets decided. And so we have Mayorkas, this fellow who I think has been trying to go at this war more or less methodically, and who's being castigated the talk about impeachment for the failure to solve the border problems. Now, the border problems have gotten worse during the period of Biden's. Lots of it has to do with the numbers of people at the border and what's gone on there. A lot of it has to do with the need to rescind the Title 42 order, which was based on the COVID health emergency, which blockaded essentially all of the immigration for a while.
You know, Sandy, you just get to a point where, you know, Republicans have birthed this problem from the perspective of these younger Republicans who are just diametrically opposed to any inner workings with Democrats and Republicans to try to come up with any solutions. And Mike Johnson, the new speaker, is now facing, you know, an improbable reality because he had to come to grips with, hey, at some point in time, Sandy, we've got to work together. And so he's compromising some. But now they're calling for his ouster because they don't want him compromising at all. They want it to be one way. And so they've created these monsters. And now they can't seem to rein them in, Sandy. How is it ever going to get any better?
Well, like I said, you know, like the border problem, apparently, and I'm not familiar with all the details of what it is that the conservatives are demanding in exchange for letting up on, for instance, the Ukrainian aid or all the things they want to hold hostage for the border solution. But my sense is that what's being proposed is not a comprehensive solution to the border problem. And without a comprehensive solution, it's not going to get solved. And there's a lot of complex demographic issues associated with the border. I mean, shutting down the border on the South and not allowing any, for instance, Latin immigration from the South is not what the public wants. And it is not what our economy needs. And it is not the right solution. So if that isn't the right solution, then what is the right solution? And that what is the right solution question is the thing that isn't getting answered by Washington.
But Sandy, they've tied that into spending, the spending bill. They've tied that into support for Ukraine and Israel. And so if they can't get that solved, you can't get the other thing solved.
Well, they tied it. The question from in my mind is just what is the it? What is
right.
it that needs to happen at the southern border that will satisfy those in Congress who are holding these other things hostage? What is the demand in the hostage, and is it a reasonable demand? And the news media doesn't seem able to explain it to us exactly what it is. What it is, you know, what is it that is being demanded by the right that would be acceptable as in exchange for then liberating all these other issues.
So, Sandy, do you think it is because the right themselves have differing views of what that it is and they can't work that out amongst themselves?
Maybe. You know, I it's not clear to me that the demand, that the demand for it is a unified demand.
Right.
And that the public has any understanding of what it is that's being demanded. And so we end up with an argument that's much like the debt ceiling argument. It's kind of it's got lots of complexities to it. And therefore, the argument's happening in the dark inside the Beltline in Washington.
So let me ask you, Sandy, from, you know, eons ago, people and elected officials didn't always agree with one another, even if they were in the same party. But they were able to come together collectively for what's in the best interest of the nation. And so have we ever been at this kind of point in history, Sandy, where we can't, where the people just can't seem to work these things out. I mean, at some point in time, they have to work this out. It can't go on at infinitum, can it? I mean, the amount of damage. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it seems like it's gone on infinitum, right? I mean, right. It's been going on for at least 20 years. And so I don't know. I don't know whether whether our government is capable of solving a problem like this, because my sense is that the problem itself is what is politically attractive.
So the only way
to solve the people.
Oh, go ahead, Sandy.
Well, there are people who want to describe the problem and have the problem as a point of attack against those who apparently are standing in the way of solving the problem. But we don't understand what the solution to the problem is. So to me, it's an argument that is completely based on emotion and not based on a factual discussion.
So, and the worst part about all of it, Sandy, is the impact that it's having on, as you always talk about, the American people, who have no control over this. Well, we do have control over it only because of whom we elect, right? I mean, that's the only control that we have over it, is to see that the representative that we've elected is one of those who's causing this mayhem. And we'll maybe have a come to Jesus moment and say, hey, Sandy, I got to get rid of Sandy. I thought he was somebody else.
Well, yeah, so what we've got now is one party blaming the other party for the problem. We have a problem that is broadly defined, that is in fact a problem, obviously, for a number of cities and a number of localities. We have a problem that's in some respects overblown in terms of how it's described. And then we have no solution that's ever discussed factually to the problem other than, for instance, a wall. But a wall was never going to be a solution to the bigger problem, okay? It was only going to be a barrier for some illegal entrance, okay? And we still have the broader problem of making all the policy decisions associated with immigration.
So, Sandy, what would they get out of impeaching Mayorkas? They keep saying we're going to impeach Mayorkas. What would they get out of that?
Well, impeaching Mayorkas brings into the newspaper every day this immigration issue, okay? It's just another way of highlighting it. Now they're saying, see here, we're doing something about it. Well, they're not doing anything about the immigration issue by getting rid of Mayorkas, but that's the fallacy of the whole argument so far, is that the people who describe the argument, who will say they want to do something about it, aren't actually talking about solving the problem.
But they can't get rid of Mayorkas. Is that a decision?
Secretaries, you can impeach and remove cabinet officials.
Yeah,
Congress can do that.
It would take both Democrat and Republicans
to
do it, right?
Oh, yeah. They'd have to, the Senate has, it operates just like the impeachment of a president. It would have to happen the same way. It's not going to happen. It's theater.
Yeah. Well, you know, you just get to a point where, you know, I become frustrated with it because it's endless. None of these things, again, now I'm reading where President Biden is now saying he's going to, you know, get rid of a lot of student debt. And so can he do it? He's tried to do it now for 3 years, but now apparently there's a way that he's found, maybe because of elections, to figure out a way.
Well, he has found. I mean, they've eliminated. I don't know the number exactly, but it's many billions of dollars of student debt that have been forgiven under the powers that apparently the president does have under various elements of the student debt program, and they keep trying to find more ways that the president has unilateral authority. You know, maybe he will. He's not going to be able to do the entire package that they've talked about that would require congressional action. But he has limited debt, and he's exercised some of the sort of the powers that he has that are emergency style powers.
So now we'll talk about something we haven't talked about in a while. That's business, the business community, the business climate in the nation. How is it standing up? And clearly they're making a lot of money, but where is it at now?
Well, that's what's curious to me. The Republicans and Trump, for instance, Trump a couple of days ago talked about how fragile the economy was, how the country's in terrible shape. People keep talking about that. The country's in terrible shape, and they don't describe why. I mean, I will say that the middle class has problems, but the middle class has problems that are in spite of whatever the Republicans have done, and probably because of some of what the Republicans have done, and the lack of the government being responsive for programs for them. But as far as the economy's concerned, it's very solid. You know, we've experienced a soft landing, no recession, and the outlook for this coming year looks quite sound for the economy. Is it fragile? I don't think it's any more fragile than it ever is. The economy got some potentially unexpected turns it can take, but no, I mean, jobs are robust. In fact, the last month we had more jobs again filled than we expected. Inflation went up slightly, which shows the power of the power of consumer demand right now. The stock market is responding favorably to our conditions. Wall Street seems to feel pretty positive about the way things are going.
Wouldn't any other time in history with those things you just said be a very positive sign for an incumbent president?
Yeah. Typically, incumbent presidents do very well when the economy is as it is right now. But the problem, I think, is that the economy's architecture, which we can talk about after the turn here, gives a problem to middle class America, which can be talked about by either party anytime.
844-967-2789. Take a short hiatus. Show as always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means the last few minutes of the show with Sandy Williams. Sandy, the economy. And I guess we really don't think about it as much, but the nation could have very easily had fallen into recession in the last 4 years, right? I mean, it was right on the precipice.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the economists were all predicting coming out of the COVID recession, we ended up with the inflation. Then there was a clear view that the inflation would be ended by a recession. And, you know, the fact is we didn't have one, but it's a bit, again, like proving the negative. We didn't have a recession, so we didn't experience the negative. But the problem for any politician and any incumbent right now is that the architecture of the economy is such that the middle class suffers. Okay, the middle class is living paycheck to paycheck, and they're not living paycheck to paycheck because there's something about the economy that can fix it. other than some massive changes in the structure of the economy that would pay this middle class a lot more, the reason they're suffering is because of the benefits they're not receiving, okay? So you could give that middle class a $1,000 tax reduction, and they're still going to have child daycare costs and health costs and student debt costs and the various costs that could be replaced by the government programs. There ought to be affordable education. There ought to be health care that's affordable and accessible. There ought to be child daycare. Those things get plugged back in, and the middle class is no longer straining as it is today. But if someone wants to stand back and say the economy is in bad shape, there are people who are going to believe it, okay? Even though the economy measured on all of the broad scales is in great shape, the people who are going to...
Yeah, so Sandy, you know, I would say to you that it doesn't matter whether it's a Democrat or a Republican as it relates to that, right?
It does matter. Well, it doesn't matter with respect to that problem.
Right.
But only one party, only one party is going to speak to the solutions to it. We're not going to have, I heard DeSantis talking about this very issue in his debate, but he's not going to come forward with the programs that will solve the problem for that middle class family, which is child daycare funding and dealing with the student debt and with the cost of post-secondary education and with healthcare costs and healthcare access and retirement costs and retirement savings. Okay, those are the problems faced by the middle class, and they better start addressing that by looking politically for the answers to that rather than an expression of their frustration and anger like Donald Trump.
So, Sandy, where I'm perplexed with it is whether or not it's the business community that can solve it or whether or not it's the government that needs to solve it. Or is it a combination of both?
Well, it's a combination of both, and it's because the government, the corporations and businesses have so much power over the government that it's going to require them to get behind it. But, you know, we're going to need to change the way benefits are realized by middle-class America, number one. And number two, we're going to have to get wages such that two working wage earners, breadwinners in a household, do better than $75,000 a year when you realize how $75,000 a year doesn't go very far.
And that's not going to happen overnight. Jack from Merrimack. Jack, quickly.
Yeah, this is the major issue in my mind. The Republicans never address it either. And yes, Democrats do to some extent. And that is, you have major corporations, and all of them are dedicated to maximizing profits, cutting wages, cutting employment as low as possible, calling their actual employees independent contractors, and as was pointed out, not giving benefits of any kind to those wage earners. And if there's any instability in the economy, it is not the fault of the Democrats. It is not the fault of a Democratic administration. It is the fault of major corporations, which, by the way, were partial recipients of $2 trillion just a few years ago in welfare tax giveaways. So people have to realize that, and it sounds socialistic to say we've got to do something about these big corporations, but in fact, there are laws on the books that do try to address the almost monopolistic practices.
Hey, Jack, thank you very much for the call. Sandy, you want to respond to Jack?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is true that the design of our economy is beginning to fail. And it's beginning to fail because of this change in the way benefits are realized and the compensation scales that are being paid. Too many businesses have business models that are premised on low compensation for their employees, minimum wage type earning. So, you know, our economy is getting fragile. It's not fragile because of something that the incumbent president is doing. Our economy is fragile because the social stress that it's putting our middle-class families under is creating social fragility.
Hey, Sandy, great. Thank you, as always. You're comfortable at home.
Yeah.
We'll talk soon. Thank everybody who made the show go. Be careful out there on the roads. I mean, really, you got to really be careful. Calvin, as always, thank you, man. Great week. Couldn't do it without you. Up next, Jane Mettenair. And
Mettenair on air.
Mettenair on air. All right. See you guys later. Be safe.